please the court, counsel. Megan Hayes, I'm here representing the appellant defendant, Dr. Shakeel Khan. Sorry.
You'll need to keep that close.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I keep thinking I'm going to bump into it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you bet. This case is about a defendant's Sixth Amendment qualified right to counsel. Judge Hart, I believe you've been involved in a couple cases here at the Tenth Circuit where the court has recognized that that right includes the right to be represented by a qualified attorney whom the defendant can afford to hire and a fair opportunity to secure counsel of choice. In this situation, the district court made a determination after a hearing that Dr. Khan was not entitled to a Jones hearing regarding his forfeiture and seizure restraint of his assets. And the court only reached the first prong, the first of two prongs of the Jones analysis. And the court determined that Dr. Khan theoretically had $95,000. So he had some assets, and that was enough.
Well, the $95,000 was the equity in the house, and then he said he also had $3,000 income from his business.
Theoretically $95,000.
There was also discussion of an account that the defendant and his wife had apparently taken some, put some funds in, and some $30,000 or something of it had disappeared. So I think there was a presumption that they might also have that. So it could be, in addition to the $3,000 a month, it's something more than just the equity, I guess is what I'm saying.
Correct, Your Honor, but still inadequate given the record that was made at the hearing
as to what the counsel expenses through, and
the government had moved and was their motion was granted to declare the case complex. This is a multi-state, multi-agency investigation. I think that the government in its motion indicated that there was 50 gigabytes. I don't even really know what that means, but it's a lot of investigative materials. So this is a complex case. At the hearing, Tom Fleener, the then trial counsel for Dr. Khan, submitted affidavits both from Dr. Khan and from himself, and indicated to the district court that this could be a two-month trial. We're going to need experts. We will need investigators. I've got paralegal expenses. I'm probably going to need a second chair. And at the core of this case is Dr. Khan's right to retain the counsel that he's chosen to put forward the best defense that he can to the charges. And what the district court has done and what the government did at the hearing by saying, well, those defense costs are really irrelevant, is really infringing. It's impeding his right to retain counsel of his choice. And that is fundamental to the Sixth Amendment. I don't think there's any doubt since the Powell versus Alabama decision in 1932, that's a Supreme Court case, that the right to counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment includes the right to retain counsel of your own choosing.
That's not entirely unlimited, though.
No, you're right. It is a qualified right. It's not an absolute right. But by qualified, that means that a defendant can't insist on an attorney that he or she can't afford, or the defendant can insist on having an attorney that's been disbarred or disqualified. So, yes, you're correct. It is qualified in some way. But if Dr. Khan can establish that his, and he did establish, that he doesn't have sufficient assets to retain his attorney, who has told the court that defending this case is going to cost $500,000, he's met the first prong of the Jones test. And
well, he hasn't technically, because the Jones test says that he has to have no assets other than those restrained. He uses the word no. And the trial court made a big point to say he's got some assets here.
The trial court did make that determination, but that's what this is appeal is about.
I understand.
Is that all of the other cases, at least that I have read from this circuit, cases they're cited in the brief, there has been extensive consideration of the cost of the defense as compared to the defendant's available assets. The Gordon case, for example, I think the government seized $5 million worth of assets, and the court determined that the defendant was worth $8 million. He just filed a loan, requested a loan from a bank, and had indicated that his net worth was $8 million, almost $9 million. And so this court said, well, he's got enough. He's got $3 million and he did hire counsel of his choice who vigorously defended him at trial. So there was no violation of the Sixth Amendment right.
But they didn't really reach this question that we had. I didn't think any of the cases that you cited really hit this kind of on the head, which is you've got some assets here. It's not nothing. And you have some continuing income. And that's a little different than each of the cases that you cited. The one district court case you cited or somebody cited, the Whitted case, seems to be it was interesting to me because you had this situation where the court said, well, they have some assets. Basically, it may not be enough to pay, but they've got some assets. And then, so no. But then later on down the road, with respect to Defendant Lake, they came back and said, okay, well, now they don't have any assets. And I see that. And so now, I don't know if that's the best practice, but that seemed to be the way that district court interpreted the no asset pretty literally.
Well, and
meaning it could change.
Yeah. I'm not trying to suggest that there's a lot of authority out there. There's not. But I think that the government's position that the cost of the defense is irrelevant infringes on that right. I mean, how can it not? And if you look at the transcript from the hearing in this case, Judge Johnson actually sort of was a little bit uncomfortable and said something like, you know, does Jones implicate a constitutional right? And then he said, well, can the government just say you got $20,000 and that's it, and then the government can do as it pleases, I think is the exact quote from that transcript. So he's at least... And his order says the cost of defense may be an inherent factor in Jones, but I'm not going to consider that until I get some direction from the Tenth Circuit, which I'm hoping you will provide, that says, it's a relevant consideration. It should be a consideration. Not just, okay, he's got $5,000. His defense is going to cost $500,000, and that's good enough. You can't meet the Jones test. Because this court in Jones said that the defendant's qualified right to counsel stems from a defendant's right to decide what kind of defense he wishes to present. And you need your attorney, as I said in my brief, you need your attorney now. If you don't get the attorney of your choice to present the defense that you want to present, it's a significant infringement of that right to choose your own attorney. And I think that...
Taking the Whitted case as an example, I'm not saying I think it's right or wrong, but it was a district court case, but if it appears he does have funds, at least at this point, to at least retain counsel, and why couldn't he retain counsel, and then when those funds run out, go back to the court, as the defendant did in Whitted, and say, okay, now I need to get to those funds. See what I'm saying? I mean, I'm not saying that's a. I'm just wondering
yeah,
if.
Sure. I don't know.
You're going to tell me what's wrong with
solution.
That.
I'm not sure what sort of a, what.
The only
what
court that I saw that really kind of dealt with what
Sure, but given this ruling, it would be very difficult for an attorney. I mean, I'm just thinking about, a case of this magnitude would take a lot of time, and you would get into the middle of it and perhaps right, close to trial or preparing for trial, and all of a sudden there's no money. You can't withdraw. I mean, that would really prejudice your client. And so you would have to...
The court wouldn't let you.
Sorry?
The court wouldn't let you.
No, you couldn't withdraw at that point. So you're in it. You have to continue. So
Well, you'd look for the... You'd, at that point, ask for a hearing and say, circumstances have changed, and I've run out of funds. I've done what you've told me, and I've gotten a second mortgage on my house, and I've, done everything that you told me to do, because that is what the court said here.
It would be a lot easier for this court to say, as many other courts have not said explicitly, but have done implicitly, is to decide, does this person have sufficient assets to retain counsel of his or own choosing? That's what the courts have done. They haven't said that. They haven't said the Supreme Court or the Tenth Circuit or the Seventh Circuit requires us to do that. But that's what we're doing.
Well, I understand. I looking at the cases from the other circuits, I understand that they've taken a different position. But I'm wondering if we're constrained by that pretty straightforward language we used, right or wrong, whether this panel might be constrained by the use of the term no assets. That doesn't... It's hard to get an implication there, isn't it?
I don't think it's hard because of the other language in that decision. And the fundamental reason for that decision. If you step back from the Jones case, and there's all this weighing of Matthew versus Eldridge and the government's interest versus defendant, what it is predicated on is exactly the defendant's right to counsel of his own choosing. So later, I agree, the holding in the case says no assets, but the incomplete rationale for that decision is that a defendant has the right to decide who's going to represent him. And when the government says that the costs of the defense are not relevant, I think it's impeding that right, and that is unconstitutional. So I would like to reserve a little bit of time, if it's okay, for rebuttal. I have about 2 minutes. But again, I think here, I understand what you're saying, that the precise holding says no assets, but the entire rationale for that decision goes to the heart of this case, and that is a defendant's right to counsel of his own choice. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel?
So you've got pretty explicit language from this court on your side, but no merit to the position.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's not your fault.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's the kind of the position the government has been put in. We can look at the ruling of the lower court, and it appears that the lower court applied the literal wording of the Jones appropriately, found there were not insubstantial assets, and denied a lawyer.
I need to back up just a little on this, counsel, on the procedure. Apparently, we had a hearing on whether he was entitled to a hearing.
Correct.
Okay. And in that, his predicate for saying that he was not entitled to a hearing was what?
That he still had assets?
He still had assets.
Available, yes.
No assets, some assets, enough assets?
Some assets would be the government's position at the hearing.
So basically, the trial court, the government's position has to be at this stage that he gets no hearing on whether they're adequate because Jones says no assets.
Correct.
And so, in effect, the decision not to give a hearing implicitly implies that the court adopted the no means no, because otherwise he would be making the hearing on adequacy before you get to the hearing that is supposed to illuminate that kind of a hearing. So, in other words, I want to know whether this case turns on whether no means no versus some. Because if it means some, then it seems he's entitled to a hearing as to how much some should be.
How much is needed?
Some assets. And either the court said no assets control, so you don't get a hearing, or it says he did have some assets, and therefore, in effect, the court has moved off from the no means no to an assessment as to adequacy. And if that is so, doesn't it follow automatically that he's entitled to a hearing on adequacy? Now, that's how I see the case, and you can help me work my way through it, because Jones doesn't tell us.
Correct. I think the lower court's ruling was no means no. And I think the lower court, Judge Johnson, was very clear in his ruling. I mean, he didn't say no means no, but practically speaking, that is what he said.
He couldn't have, because if he was going to say no means no, he would have simply said they have some assets, and therefore under your analysis, and I understand where it's coming from, which is the language of the case, but $1 in assets would be some assets and would be, you couldn't satisfy the no asset standard that you're saying that we imposed with $1. So why would the court then go on if he's, you know, there's no reason to go on. If there's a dollar or more, according to your interpretation of Jones, that's enough. And so the court could simply say, well, yes, you have $1 or more in assets, or any amount would do. And so I think what Judge McKay is saying is impliedly the court must think Jones means more, because it did then discuss in some fairly good detail the assets that he had.
And so instead of a strict no means no, even the court said substantial assets. He had substantial assets. He didn't have just not have
substantial
a dollar,
meaning,
but he had the substantial.
What does that mean?
Let me suggest an alternative. Because he wasn't just making a ruling, Judge Johnson. He was asking for guidance from this court. So maybe he was trying to give us a record so we could get some guidance. But I'm sorry. I just can't see how we can affirm this. I've written enough opinions and read enough of them and said, oh, why did I have that sentence in there, when it's not what you're really getting at in the opinion. You say things less precisely than you would like to, and no one pays a lot of attention to it because it doesn't affect the outcome of that case. And I just don't believe any member of that panel really thought that if you have a dollar, you can't
get
a hearing.
Technically, I think. Yeah.
And we'll confer with the expert here, who's got more experience than everybody else in this building combined.
He was on the court at that time.
So you understand the problem that I'm having. This case starts with a denial of a request for a hearing. And the reason for the hearing, it seems to me, is to assess whether it is adequate. And if we're on the no means no, then he doesn't get a hearing if he has even a trivial amount. But the reason for the hearing is obvious in this record. Some of those assets, without a hearing, the judge says they're worth this, and I thought, well, I wouldn't buy that house.
Right.
I wouldn't buy it for $100. So the purpose of the hearing, once you get past something other than de minimis, is to assess adequacy. And that's the test that ultimately, but we haven't reached that because basically the government's position is we don't have to because no means no.
Well, but I think that first hearing that we did have was the defendant's opportunity to show
but
what his assets were.
But our cases say he's entitled to a hearing, that the judge has to hold the hearing. We've got the problem of a hearing on whether to have a hearing. And the predicate for having the hearing, or whether he's entitled to a hearing, turns on whether no means no.
But I think the Jones case set forth that we don't have to have a hearing until he has made the two showings, one being no assets. So the
no means no assets.
And so that first hearing was the defendant's opportunity to make that showing, that he has no assets.
What would happen
if zero.
What would happen if he made the showing, and then, of course, he'd also have to make the second prong showing, which didn't, we don't even have any. They didn't go there here, so that would have to happen first.
Correct.
If you make both of those showings, what happens at the next hearing?
At the next hearing, then the government has to establish by probable cause that the assets that are seized are related to the crime in the indictment by probable cause.
And
which
the court has to make some sort of finding about what's a reasonable amount of money the defendant needs.
Isn't that already done? I think that's the idea, is that should already have been done at the first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
I don't think that's clear.
I think the problem with our case law is that it's not clear.
And one of the cases from one of the other circuits talks about the difficulties with a sufficiency standard is then how is that monitored? If he
right.
has $95,000 and it's $500,000, does the court monitor the bills as they come in to his private attorney and authorize and say whether or not they're reasonable? And so that may have been one of the reasons they were trying to make a more definitive line.
But after there's the hearing, and whether there's probable cause to seize, if there is probable cause to seize, then that money's off the table.
Correct.
And if there's not probable cause, then that money's on the table. So I'm not sure what the need for monitoring is at that point, because the die is cast.
Well, I think that under the way the case law reads, the only money that would be released is what he's shown that he needs for a defense. So,
if there's not probable cause to hold some of it, that's available for defense, isn't it? Even though, maybe I'm wrong about that. I think if you've shown you don't have probable cause, then you have no rights to that property until you get a conviction, if you get a conviction.
And I think as a matter of principle, I wouldn't disagree with that. But the way the case law reads is that they can get back the money that they need for their defense and not all of the money.
I thought the issue there was, why go into whether there's probable cause to seize these assets when there are a lot of assets that aren't in question that would be sufficient to pay for a good defense? But once you've had the hearing on probable cause, then there's a pile of money available and there's a pile of money that's not available. And at that point, perhaps the defendant can say, I need a public defender because this is too expensive for me to.
But I think under the Matthews test, when you weigh the first factor, which is the private interest of the defendant, the courts have said if they don't need the money, that interest goes away. And so there isn't a need for a hearing under due process if they don't meet that first, need the money.
Right.
So.
But if you have, but I'm.
If you actually have
a hearing. In terms of later monitoring, if the defendant doesn't have enough unencumbered assets to pay for an adequate defense, but the defendant has other assets that are being encumbered, then you have a hearing on the encumbrance. And once you have that hearing, then there's no need for any follow-up because there's nothing the court can do. The court isn't going to say, even though the government has probable cause, you can use that for your defense. The court's not going to do that. And the court isn't going to say, if it finds certain assets, there is a probable cause for some assets, the court is not going to say you can't use those for your defense, even though the government hasn't shown probable cause to encumber them.
I think that in some ways works an injustice to the government.
Well,
because we're entitled to seize those assets, and they only get a hearing if due process requires it. If they don't need the assets, then they shouldn't even get a hearing under the due process.
Yeah, right. They don't get a hearing. But if they do need those assets, I thought the question was whether there's some need for later monitoring by the court after this second hearing. And I'm not sure there is, because after the second hearing, it's determined which assets are encumbered and which aren't, and the defendant could use any unencumbered assets for defense as the defendant wants, and the defendant can't use any encumbered assets for the defense.
If the court unencumbers and finds there's probable cause lacking, let's say you have $3 million, $1 million of it is now unencumbered and available because they can't tie it to the crime, so it's available for the cost of defense, and let's say the cost of defense is only $750,000, doesn't the defendant he would still have... is that what you're saying, is that you want to make sure that the unencumbered assets then are actually directly used for the attorney fees? And
correct. Because
and
I
is
think,
that really your
you
role
right
at that point?
That? Yeah. Why do you have the right to care, to put some sort of hold on the other $250,000 if you haven't shown probable cause? I would think you've lost any right to constrain the defendant's use of those assets at that point.
But I think
we're
that
way ahead of ourselves.
The statutes allow the government to do that up until trial. And
right.
Due process only requires we give it back if they need it. Otherwise, we get to keep it until trial and prove at trial that it's worth it.
Even if you can't show probable cause. They're encumbered. Even if at the second hearing you can't show probable cause, they're still encumbered to some extent. They can only be used for attorney fees, is what you're saying.
Yes, because the defendant who can't show they need it, they have to wait till trial.
Yeah, I know that.
Even though
they don't even get
even
a probable
though ultimately
cause.
They might be,
right. They don't even get a hearing on probable.
But so isn't the answer that the court only unencumbers what has been estimated to be the cost of retaining counsel, and that may end up being wrong, but that's what happens. Otherwise, the court would have to monitor.
Correct.
And if you run out, you run out.
Okay.
Any more
questions?
2 seconds.
This is helpful.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a point I didn't appreciate. Wow, 2 whole minutes.
I'll talk fast. I just wanted to respond procedurally to a couple questions. The monitoring, at the hearing here, there was evidence presented in an affidavit form and by testimony, if you will, from counsel about the reasonableness of the fees. There was not a determination made about those fees because he was found to have more than $1, and that's no assets, and so you're done. You don't get.
Why did the court go ahead then, though, and spend all the time talking about, well, you got up to $95,000 here, and you got $3,000 from this, and you might have some funds from this account that you put money into and then took it out. Why did the court bother to do that if it wasn't suggesting that perhaps he did have sufficient assets? And maybe it's Judge Hartz's idea that he was just trying to make a record and... Let us know how difficult this is.
I think he's trying to make a record. There was a lot of information presented at that hearing to address both prongs of the Jones standard, including the second prong that the restrained assets were not.
Oh, there was evidence about that?
Yeah.
Oh.
But I'm sorry, it was not part of the district court's order here that's being appealed. But there was evidence, if you look at the transcripts and the exhibits that were introduced there, that income tax returns, for example, that showed that Dr. Khan had earned money prior to this alleged drug trafficking scheme that shouldn't be restrained. And so I think Judge Johnson was trying to make a record. I don't know that he thought there would be an interlocutory appeal, but I think he put the information in there because he was seeking some direction from the court. Do I have to consider the cost of defense? And there was quite a bit of evidence submitted to that. I don't think that there's any monitoring required. If there's a finding by the district court that the fees presented are reasonable and should be paid, I don't think there needs to be any monitoring. Thank you.
Over. Thank you. We got through the morning. Thank you very much for a good argument. Thank the others who preceded you today, too. Case is admitted. Counselor excused. Court is adjourned.